Hi, Alton Brown here. This is the Alton Brown Cast. We are on the road right now during the tour, and we're only talking to folks that we're encountering along the way. Since I'm playing, let's see, 1, 2, 3 Taylor guitars during the show, it made sense to come out and talk to Bob Taylor, who's responsible for those guitars. When you talk about reinventing the guitar, do you do that based on your own, just your own vision of what guitars can do, your own guitars, or do you look at the entire guitar world and strategize to against other brands, or is it just you doing what you do?
People have asked me, well, you know, what would you want to accomplish by the time you die? And my answer for 30 years has been to leave guitars, the world of guitars, in better shape than I found them. So I think in a way that's your answer. I try to look at not only our guitars, do a better job on our guitars, but make guitars in general better. Lift the whole thing. Stop doing the stuff that doesn't really work very well and try and come up with ways to do things that work better. For example, you know, our guitars are pretty well known for being easy to play and being consistent. And those are pretty objective things that you can look at in a guitar. It's either easy to play or it's not. A little bit more objective than it either sounds good or it doesn't.
Yeah, that's kind of like this food tastes great,
this food doesn't taste great.
You need to be a little bit more specific than that.
Exactly. Or you know, someone would say, this is too hot. They forget to say for me, you know, because it might not be too hot.
For everybody else in the room.
For everybody else. And so sound is something that I want to get in a good ballpark, the area of good sound, and have some reason behind that. But some of that's also based on your ability. What I'm really good at is the more objective things, the things that made guitars less of a pain to own.
Like?
You know, when I was 19 years old and I made my first guitars, and I didn't know, well, I was 16 when I made my first guitars, I didn't know anything about guitars.
Other than you wanted to make one.
Other than that. I'd never seen or touched or played any of the brands that you know about. I'd heard of this guitar called a Martin guitar. I'd never seen one. I'd heard of a Gibson. I'd never seen one.
Then what made you want to build a guitar if you didn't really even know that much about them?
Well, when I was young, I bought a $3 guitar from the kid across the street, and we put together a little folk band and played Michael Row Your Boat Ashore in the garage. I think it was my 12th birthday. My folks bought me a little Japanese electric guitar for $15 at the local Fed Mart, which became Price Club, which became Costco, right? And then when I was 16, I found a little acoustic guitar at a store. So during all that time, I was just interested in playing guitar. But my parents made the things that we had. You know, in our home, we would reupholster our own car, make our own furniture.
You were makers.
We made things. My mom sewed our clothes. My dad made our furniture. You know, I never got in trouble for taking something apart and ruining it. You know, usually in the midnight hour, I'd figure out how to put it back together.
There might be some leftover parts, but it looked the same, right?
And so I was good at making things. It was during an era when there were, we called them shop classes in junior high and high school. It was such a great time because there were robust classes in our public schools, and I fell in love with them in 7th, 8th, 9th grade, junior high school, and then in high school, and I made things. I was good at it. So it came to pass that I wanted a new guitar. Couldn't afford to buy one. I'll make one in wood shop. I could make a guitar. And then I fell in love with that.
How was that first? Do you still have it? Do you still have the first guitar? Is guitar one? Because that ought to be like in a case out by the front door.
Yeah, I have guitar. I have guitar two or three. One of three that I built in high school. The other two I destroyed along the way, like maybe setting fire to that first song you wrote or that first tape you did, because you just don't want anybody
to see. Anybody to ever see this. I don't want this to fall into the wrong hands.
Now, you probably would like someone to see it because you've proved your
right
case.
You've come far enough. Yeah.
And now I would love people to see that, and I do have one of them. It's in the early days that you're like, I got to get rid of this evidence. You know.
Yeah.
So the first guitar was a disaster, but it worked. It was a guitar. And what an awesome thing to have made in high school wood shop.
I bet you got an A.
I got an A.
Yeah, I bet you did. Other guys were like making blocks of wood, and you made a guitar.
They were putting an alligator clip on the end of a piece of wood and making a roach clip.
Making a roach clip out of it. You know what I mean? You built your roach clip onto the end of a guitar, so that's gave you the edge.
I had a great teacher in junior high school who I would build these projects in metal shop, enter them into the California State Exposition in Sacramento. I would win when I would do that.
What kind of stuff did you make that won that?
I made a jeweler's vise. I have one. I have it here that I'll show you. I made it when I was 14 years old. It'll blow your mind to think of making something like that when you're 14.
Yeah.
It's
a jeweler's vise.
Yeah.
You just needed one, so you decided to make one?
It was kind of a little project that the teacher had designed. It was a copy of a... Check this out. 2 years ago, I was in a machine tool store, and one of the greatest old line companies is called Sterrett, and they make.
I even know Sterrett, sure. Yeah.
Well, they have. I looked in the case, and it's like, that's my vise. That's my vise. I'd never seen it before in a million years, and I realized that 40 some years ago, my teacher had made a copy of this little Sterrett vise and thought that it would be a good project for an eighth grader or a ninth grader. To make that vise, you had to make wooden molds and do sand casting and forge things and cut threads and turn balls on a lathe that weren't CNC, turn like an Etch-a-Sketch, turning a cross feed and long feed and left-hand threads and right-hand threads and forging and polishing and matching surfaces with Prussian blue and a file and blah, blah, blah. And I look at that, I go, I'm not sure I can make that now. You know?
But you did when you were 14.
But I did when I was 14. And so when it came time to want a guitar, I thought, well, I could make a guitar. I could do that. And so I did. And, well, of course, I met my partner, Kurt, at a little local custom guitar shop. We both worked there. I worked there for barely a year, and the owner decided he didn't want to do it anymore. Kurt and I, through a strange set of circumstances, ended up being partners. That was 40 years ago. We started this little company. We took over the lease.
Right.
We started making guitars. We called them Taylor. We took them to some music stores.
Look good on the headstock, right?
Yeah, sounded Taylor. Good. That's a good American Taylor. Name. Yeah. I was the guitar designer. He was more interested in selling and marketing.
Which is important. That's the business.
Very important. And my worst nightmare to do something like that.
Yeah,
he's
me too.
Not really fond of working in a shop and tools, so it was perfect.
Good mixture.
Neither one of us would have made it without the other. It was a great partnership.
As you look back now over the many years of pursuing something that you love and also pursuing the excellence of the thing that you love, can you look at a particular point or an event or a particular guitar where the scales tipped towards this is going to be a success? I mean, has it always just been an uphill road, or was there one thing that you did, one innovation you made, one decision that you guys made at a company that set you firmly on the road to being what you are today, which is, you know, one of the greats?
Imagine a spring and a little train riding on a track up that spring, and you're going around in circles, but you're climbing as you go. And that train has an engine and a caboose and some stuff in between.
Mm-hmm.
And the longer that train is, the more behind the caboose is than the engine, and the more ahead the engine is than the caboose.
Yeah.
I tried to keep the train short so that everything that we did was sort of matched. In other words, I didn't want production that could outstrip our sales. I didn't want PR or notoriety that could outstrip our production. You waste big things that come your way. You have to be ready for big things that come your way. So when we were small, it was all small. And when we were medium, it was all medium. And when we're big, it's all big.
So you've kept it in proportion.
We tried to keep it in proportion. And so to answer your original question, I'm thinking of little whistle stops along that spring as you go up. So some examples. 5, 6, 7 years into it, we were making guitars. We had no idea. We didn't know how to make guitars. We didn't know how to... I was 19 years old when I started. I mean, you know, didn't know the first thing about anything except that I knew how to make things. And we discovered along the way that we would try and get our work done, and it wouldn't get done. Maybe we'd want to make 10 guitars in a month, so we'd start this batch. and a month would go by and they're not done, and 2 months would go by and we lost four, and 2.5 months would go by and five got finished. So instead of 10 guitars in a month, it was five guitars in 2.5 months. Our financial plans would fall apart. We're broke as could be. There was one particular, probably my biggest aha moment in the whole entire time of being in business, was visiting a luthier, a guitar maker that was back east in New Jersey, and his name was Agostino Laprinzi. He still makes guitars now. He lives down in Florida. And I watched his little shop. It was a one-man shop, maybe he had an employee, and he had not a batch of guitars going. He had a guitar that was almost done and a guitar that was partly done and parts for another guitar, and he was gluing the bridge on a guitar. I said, "How many guitars do you make, Augie?" And he says, "Well, I make a, I can't remember, let's say he made a guitar a day. Well, don't you make 10 at once so you can take advantage of, you set up to make bridges, don't you want to make 10 bridges?" And he just looked at me and said, "Bob, what do you want, 10 half-done guitars or one done guitar?" And that just hit, that would be what today we would call lean manufacturing, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody seems to know about that, even if they don't know about that.
If they don't know, yeah, know. Conceptually.
And
now, does that mean that he, but he may, he had several going in several stages, though.
That means, I mean, if he, would, he needed a bridge, he'd make a bridge.
A bridge.
Because what does it get me to make tomorrow's bridge today? What does it get me? It gets me a bunch of time I spent making something that I don't need yet. And so
he'd rather spend more time making a bridge when he needed it than less time making bridges he didn't need.
Yeah, and the magic, sometimes things, there's magic to things, things that defy the conventional wisdom. Because in the end, you don't spend more time making a bridge, because you make it every day and you get really good at it. You say, "Well, I don't want to waste the setup time."
But the setup time makes you better.
At the setup time. I mean, do you really want to chop all your onions for next week? Or do you just want to chop one that you need right now? It only takes a second. You know, you scoop it all in. It takes a second. You do it, and you're good.
Make it when you need it.
And you don't make the wrong things. You know? So
I have found that certainly in the culinary world and in the world of making a food show, the stuff that you end up wasting because you did it wrong was the stuff you were doing ahead.
All the time.
And I think part of that comes from focus,
mm-hmm.
from really focusing on what it is you need when you need it. So I am a make a bridge when you need a bridge kind of guy, personally.
I think that that's the best way. And he taught me that with that one question. And I've asked that question to 50 guitar builders along the way who are bemoaning how hard it is to get this done. And very few grasp it the way I did. That was a life-changing moment. That was an aha moment, a come-to-Jesus moment, a turn-around-and-go-the-other-way moment for me. And I came home and I said, "We're not making 10 guitars at a time anymore, ever again. We're making one guitar at a time, and we're going to have this production cycle where, in reality, we made a whole guitar every day, but it was based on guitars moving down a little assembly line of one guitar, you know." And what happened is, you would look and go, "Well, that's a bottleneck. I'm going to work on that." Your bottlenecks all of a sudden were so obvious, right?
Right.
And so one of the great successes of our company is that we have manufacturing prowess. We get our work done. We make a lot of guitars, and they're all good. And then the other great success I would attribute to my partner, when he really figured out how to, I'm going to say, market our guitars, how to get advertising, how to set us apart from other people. And there was a time there when he just really had some great realizations and put together stuff that made a huge difference. When you opened magazines back in those days, it was the early, mid-80s, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Every single ad in the book was, "We make the finest guitars out of the finest materials, guaranteed for the longest time, played by the most famous people." That was the ad. Didn't matter what brand it was in it. They all looked the same. And then one day you opened up a magazine and there was a two-page spread with blue sky and a plane, you know, like a prairie, and one tree sticking up in the middle. And it said, "Out of all the trees in the forest, only a few get picked to play beautiful music." Come to think of it, it's kind of that way with people too, and a little tiny Taylor guitar's down on the corner, you know. And he started, we called it the Trees Campaign, and he started doing this campaign like that. And people stopped and took notes, like, really? You said something about the wood, the tree, and you said something about me, and you called it a day. And that really set a tone for how it is that we presented ourselves to the public.
And that was not only a radical step away from what was being done at the time, but it was actually more in line with your DNA, the DNA of what you do.
Absolutely.
Which is, you know, if I believe anything about brand, it's you've got to be, every single thing you do has to be true to what your brand is, what you are.
That's exactly right. And we realized during those times that, well, the guitar gods had already come, already chosen the guitars they're playing. We don't have, we came on the scene too late to get Eric Clapton or, you know, just go down the list. So who are we going to make the star of our guitars? There's not one endorsement advertisement of Taylor guitars in 40 years. Not one. And we made our customer the star, and we made the guitar the star. It's all, everything that we've said in our marketing is about you, the player, and how that guitar kind of relates to you and how you feel about playing. You know, if you really go back to the big league sales of, you know, we're selling the sizzle, not the steak, you know what I mean? But we were able to invite our customers into our living room, so to speak, with our Wood and Steel magazine and the things that we've done.
Which is a great magazine.
Oh, thank you very much. And it brings people in. We found that people who play guitar are passionately interested in the guitar itself, not just the music. They're so interested in the guitar itself. I mean, I'm not that interested in my socks, you know, or how they
make
my
But you don't make
jeans.
Socks.
Exactly. But, you know, there people could be interested in fashion, but they're not necessarily interested in how it's made. They're just interested in how it
no,
looks.
No, but you don't use fashion. It's like, I'm fascinated by the way knives are made because
exactly.
I use them. Yes. I'm interested in your guitars because I now use them. Yeah. If it's something where I'm going to express myself through or my skill set through, that's different
totally
than
different.
Something I wear.
And that's a huge advantage for us because it allows us to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. That does make things different, doesn't it?
So what if business, I was a foundry and I was casting, you know, aluminum?
That's tough. It's a tough one.
How do you make a mark?
Yeah.
How do you make a brand there? So the fact that we make guitars has been this calling card into so many places. And our businesses is, I don't know how deep it is, but it's 100 miles wide. You know,
well, it's 100 miles wide. It doesn't have to be very deep.
That's right.
Does it?
So, you know that saying, I'm 5 miles wide and an inch deep.
Yeah.
But our business includes forestry,
mm-hmm.
just the finishing, putting the finish on a guitar, spraying the lacquer that's a lifetime pursuit.
Sure
just
it is.
Figuring out how to be environmentally sound. And, you know, we have a sawmill in Africa now, and we have, co-op operations down in Honduras now, and, you know, getting our fingers out to that, all the way to having a backstage pass to a TV show or a concert. You see how far this one product takes you? It's amazing. I don't know of very many things that takes you to the farthest points of the world to look for the materials.
I'm sure that in, you know, upper end car manufacturing or something where something exotic is needed. But in those cases, it's usually exoticism for exoticism's fate. What I mean is it doesn't matter in the actual, you know, if I have fancy wood on the dash of my car, it's just there for looks. It's not right. Part of the soul of the instrument. Whereas you need that, to make how important is it to you that you can look at a Taylor guitar and say, you know, good was done all along the way in this. I mean, you seem to be relatively passionate about making sure that you're getting the right wood from the right places, the right way. Is that?
It's everything to me.
Why? Because it isn't, you know, to most, except as marketing.
I think that when a company does exist, that it should be able to say that it serves its clients, its shareholders, its employees, and its vendors. That business should serve all four of those groups.
Okay.
I think that if a business is only about its clients, it's not a good business. I think if it's only about its shareholders, it's not a good business. I think we have to serve everybody. I don't want to think that somebody had to suffer for somebody else to play a nice guitar. And there really are, we really are, over a period of years, we've become disassociated from where does our stuff come from?
Yeah.
Don't even get me on factory farming, you know.
Oh, we can talk about that.
Man, let me tell you, I've kind of become a vegan lately.
Well, I know. We're going to talk about that.
Yeah. How big of a nasty wake are we leaving behind us to do what we're doing?
Pretty big one, actually.
Yeah. And how can we improve that? By being the owner of a company that says, this is for me and my house, here's what we're going to do.
This is how we're going to play it.
This is how we're going to do it. And I've been to these places, and I think, you know, these people here that we take natural resources from, this has got to stop. And so, you know, it's like the Chinese proverb. I can't remember exactly how it's said, but a person lets a butterfly go, and someone says, well, that's one butterfly out of billions. Who cares? And the answer is, well, that butterfly cared, you know. And so I'm finding myself, after all these years, being funneled down the road to, I'm going to say environmentalism for a lack of better word, but maybe it's not that. Maybe it's sustainability.
I think it's conservation.
Conservationist,
which is that you're tending, you're looking at the bigger picture, you know, and tending the larger picture of,
yeah, and,
of
and don't you think
sustainability, you know,
sustainability. And, you know, I think, well, it took from Adam and Eve till year 1900 to get a billion people. Then it took from 1900 to 2000 to get 6 billion people. So almost everything we do will just keep our nose above water because the population is increasing. I can't believe how many guitars we make. I like doing that, but I want to somehow do it in a good way. So now we're looking at what is the succession of us? How can we plant and farm and do husbandry of trees or forests that we're directly responsible for so that people can make and have guitars a long time from now? And that's a long, the time cycle on that is longer than maybe some countries will exist. You know, we're looking at 50 years for a short period and 100 to 200 years for a long period. But I'm finding myself thinking that might be where my fortune goes when I die, is to set up stuff like that. Right now in Fiji, we can harvest mahogany because the British planted it there 100 years ago. Now, the only problem is that in Fiji, politically, they're fighting over the mahogany. So you can't get it. Now that it's ready to be done, I don't know if you know, but 9 years ago, there was a big political coup and Fiji was kicked out of the Commonwealth. And then they
I
got
knew about
in,
that, but I didn't know the reasons
over
behind it.
Mahogany. It's all about the mahogany. And so what happens is people, you go, wow, isn't that the nicest little Cinderella story? They planted mahogany and now there's an economy. Well, now we have to fight over that. So getting the wood off of that is almost, it's hard. But it will get solved when everyone's done fighting. And something will happen and wood will come out of there. You could see the problem. And 100 years is a young mahogany tree. But there's enough of it there with good husbandry. It could last forever if you don't over-harvest it, which you could say about forests, too.
Oh, it's the coffee machine.
Yeah,
someone's making a cappuccino. How many? We do all kinds of terrible things there. Where can you even list all the places you get wood from?
Yeah, I could rattle them off.
I'd love to hear.
From Africa. Our ebony comes from Cameroon. We get East Indian rosewood from India. We get spruce from Alaska, parts of Canada. Some spruce comes from the U.S., Engelmann spruce, but in very small quantities. Well, I'm going to say the lower 48, Alaska.
Okay, yep, sure.
The Sitka spruce comes from southeast Alaska, the islands. There's maple that we get from the Pacific Northwest, that's Pacific Coast. We call it broadleaf maple. We get hard rock maple from the east coast of the U.S. We get walnut from walnut orchards in California when they're ready to take the trees out. We get coco bolo from Mexico and blackwood from Tasmania and koa from Hawaii.
Are you constantly looking for new types of wood to use, more sustainable woods to use, or do you think you've pretty much found every wood that you could possibly make a guitar out of?
I believe that we know of most of the woods, so mostly, let me say this, sometimes there's a wood species, but you can't get there from here. There's no way to go in and get it and have a commercial supply of it.
Okay.
Because our industry, even with all the guitars we make, for a lot of new species that haven't been developed into a popular guitar wood yet, you would have to find a species that maybe the cabinet business or the architectural business already using, and then you cream
right.
off the guitar quality wood, and you're riding on the back of that. But if that wood's not being used for that industry, then you have to sustain the infrastructure of that industry as one manufacturer.
And you can't do that as one manufacturer.
However, to get the future of guitar woods is more primitive and smaller, not more big and modern. And so the way we get a lot of our wood now is by going back in time, so to speak. So, for example, we get a lot of our mahogany from Honduras, where we work with three communities that we have just a beautiful system that's so sustainable. These communities are you drive for 8 hours, then you walk for an hour. And there's 40 homes in each of these three communities. And left alone, they'd probably have to move into the city to find a job. But because we're there and we help them set up sawmills, they can go take a few trees, and we're allowed to take them from a UNESCO World Heritage Site to actually take trees from that. They cut a few mahogany trees each year. It's what they can do. It's not too much, right? And we buy from them, so and the wood goes directly to them, and it gives them 50% of their annual income for the community.
How many of these sawmills have you set up, do you figure?
There's only three.
I mean, that's it. Worldwide, Honduras. That's what you had in there in Honduras.
Those,
okay.
those three. But we also bought a ebony sawmill in Cameroon. There is no way to do that type of a community-based thing in Cameroon. Let's just save words and say it's impossible to do that. We have
Got
to
it.
Own that. And the reason that we did that is because of the traceability and the legality and the ethics of all of this has become so important that in that species, we couldn't leave it up to somebody else, that we couldn't trust to make what we call legalized wood, which is illegal wood that gets legalized at the at the port or a bureaucratic office. We have to go in there ourselves and say, no, we have a zero tolerance policy on bribes. You don't get our dollar to let us through this gate or whatever, because those countries really are they're emerging countries, and they have to stop that practice if they're ever going to get there. The EU is putting pressure on them. So to go in there, do it ethically, pay people properly, be bribe-free, get wood from where it's legally, have permits that you paid for, pay your taxes. We have to fight there to pay our taxes. I mean, literally. We have to start a battle with the tax office to pay the taxes, because it'll really start out with, well, I'm going to charge you all this money based on this, that, and that, but if you just give me 800 euros, we'll close the whole books. No, we just want to pay our taxes. Okay,
So it actually gets harder to do business when you're trying to do it right.
Multitudes harder, because you're leaving out people who depend on that cooperation, so to speak, is the nice word for it.
Yeah, I know what cooperation means.
Yeah, they're depending on that for their living, because their whole system is set up to where that's where their living comes from. But so that's an uphill battle there. But we've been able to sustain that. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done. Those things are very important. Our spruce, which comes from the United States, really comes from a supplier, but he's a guy like me who started this company of his years ago, and he's the only one like himself. It's a small mill. There's 20 people there. It's I say it's Paul Bunyan meets Martha Stewart. You should see the place.
That's an interesting picture.
Yeah, it's gardened, and it's beautiful, and it's lovely, and they've got steam shovels, for crying out loud, and chainsaws with 10-foot bars on them, and they're cutting up spruce logs that they bring in from Alaska and turning it into guitar tops for us and Martin and everybody else that makes guitars in the U.S. They do a fine job of it. When you get wood from the United States, you don't have to worry about the legality of it.
Because it's been done,
it's
typically.
It's these tropical hardwoods that are really so hard to vet and to ensure that laws aren't being broken. And it's, people think that they know about it, but they don't.
just ask Gibson.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so much worse out there than you think it could be, that it's like other things that are worse than you think it could be. We're blind to it as consumers. And I like to say, and I'm trying to change this because I'm vocal about it, but I'd like to say that currently most guitar buyers are very environmentally concerned, except on the day that they buy their guitar. You know, at that time they want, you know, there's always ironies going on, but at the same time, the guitar buyer really wants me to handle it for them and say, this is good wood. And I think that's completely fair. That's my job, and it's completely fair. And so I'm working really hard to do that, not just as a marketing tool, not that way, because I think that's how it has to be. You know, there's sometimes you just have a principle, and you just have to follow that principle. You know?
Well, and there are always going to be people that are willing to pay for that principle. I mean, I will pay more for something to know that somebody has made it properly, the right way, with the right materials.
Right.
I'm not saying that objects have souls, but or karma, but I just know that I'll pay more to not have to wonder about that. It means something.
That's the idea with third-party certifiers like, say, FSC or somebody like that, thinking that if you do use that wood, that you can use it to market. And we speak to our customer on a regular basis, and we have for a long time. We go all the way back to those days when we said, come on into our living room. So our customers tend to believe us, and I try and people will pay more, and sometimes they have to. Sometimes we say, this is how it needs to be done. But I'm asking people to do something harder than pay more. I'm asking people to change their mind about what they have a preconceived notion in is about what is good or what is not good. I'll give you a good and white example.
Good.
Ebony is black, and sometimes there's white in it. And people for 2,000 years since the pharaohs have thought only the black ebony is good. But the reality of the forest is that 10% of the ebony is black and the rest of it has brown and white streaks in it. So I'm now using that ebony on the guitars more and more and more and more, because now that I'm cutting the ebony, I see what's behind the curtain. And so I'm not coming to my customer and saying, I want you to pay more for the black ebony, which they would. I say, I want you to do something a lot harder than that. I want you to change your mind about what's beautiful and buy ebony that has some brown marbling in it, right? Oh, well, my dad and my dad before me told me that ebony needs to be black. And I go, yeah, but this is a different time. And now I'm asking you to change your mind, which is a lot harder than asking somebody to pay more. And those are the things that I'm highly interested in doing.
Changing people's minds.
Changing their mind.
So you decide, you look at this ebony, and this ebony that has white and brown in it, we use this metaphorically speaking, mm-hmm. Sounds, for what its purpose is in a guitar, is just as good as ebony that doesn't have any brown or white in it.
Absolutely as good. Close your eyes, you never know
the difference. It's functionally identical.
Functionally identical, and it's a different color. Now, here's the amazing thing. When I tell that story, I did this little, I don't know, they turned a camera on me and I talked for 11 minutes about what I've seen over there. It's a little YouTube, but it's got a lot of hits. And people just go, Bob, that's the most amazing primer on what's going on in the forest that I've ever seen. And my next guitar, I don't want it black. You know. So what's really great is that the consumers, if they know, they change their mind. They just have to know, and it has to be important.
It shocks me that that's not the norm, because what I've learned in my business is the more people understand, the more they appreciate.
That's right.
Simple as that. Education and advertising are the same thing when Absolutely. Done properly. Yeah. The best way to advertise something is to educate somebody because that invests their mind in it.
Absolutely.
That has been the thing when I started making food shows. My thing was I don't want to give people recipes. I want to give them understanding of what's going on in the food because that gives them ownership on it. Otherwise, they're just replicating somebody else's idea.
Yeah, that way they can open the refrigerator and go, what's in there? What can I make with that?
Exactly. That was my goal with Good Eats is to be right. able to open up the refrigerator and the pantry anywhere and say dinner's in an hour
right.
based on what you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not something that everybody would subscribe to. There are a lot of things that people just don't want to know. And there are a lot of people out there that purposely do not want to know. You know, because they don't want to have to think about it. Certainly with where their food comes from. I don't want to think. People don't want to think about where beef comes from in this country. People should have to, I think, because I appreciate food on a different level because I do know what it takes to raise a steer properly as opposed to in a feedlot someplace.
And you do know that it's changed in your lifetime. Just like wood has changed
yes.
in my lifetime. When you and I were young, you could go see a farm. Your
yes.
mom and dad could go, I'm going to take you to see a farm.
You want to go see a farm? Let's go.
You can't really do that now.
It's difficult. It's difficult.
Very, very, very hard. It's,
yeah.
it's rare to do that. And so what's hard is when someone asks the question, or they make a statement, it's just really hard for me to believe that now's the time where we're really out of trees. I've heard it for so long. Or it's really hard for me to believe that that's what they do with meat. Or you know what I'm saying.
Sure.
They haven't realized that it really has changed. It really is different. If I took my mom and dad, who are in their 80s now, and said, I want to teach you about our food supply, they'd be like, I just find that hard to believe. They would have a
well,
hard time believing that.
Not believing takes less energy than believing.
That's right.
Because with belief comes conviction.
Right.
And conviction requires action.
Yep.
It has to. So most people, when they say, I just can't believe that, what they're really saying is, I don't want to believe that.
Yeah, I don't. And a lot of people
And I don't
say,
want to be troubled with that. And
I don't want to
bother with that. I don't want to know. What I don't know won't hurt me or
so
anybody
when,
else.
So when I buy an ebony mill and I go over there, I can't say that everything that I have a goal now was the goal then.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'm going to go over there. I'm going to get into this myself. I'm going to do it right. And then I go over there and it's like, oh my gosh, I had no idea. Well, I can't unknow that. I just can't unknow what I know.
Right.
And then I can't disregard it either. I have to act on it. I actually have to act on it. Some people say, well, when you went over there and found out how bad it is, why did you buy that company? I said, well, because I want to use ebony. And now that I know how bad it is, I can't possibly buy ebony from anybody.
So I got to do something.
So I have to buy it in order to have it.
That's right.
The only way around it was through it.
The only way around it was through it.
You know?
Have you ever had a situation in all these years where you did, you opened the door, you saw what's on the other side, and then just decided, I'm just going to close this door and go somewhere else?
Yeah, I have a little saying that I say, I don't mind making a mistake as long as I do it on purpose, you know? And I can't think of any big example of that, because if it was really something that really mattered, no. But there are a lot of times where you just say, we do this wrong, but we're not ready to fix that yet. We're going to fix this and this. You just, for example, the NGOs that work out there will come up and go, are you replanting? Are you mm-hmm. cutting the 70? Are you replanting? It's like, you want to ruin a cocktail party really fast? Just ask me if I'm replanting. My answer, I have two answers. One is, you have no idea what you're even asking. I mean, that's a question I can't really answer. Or I could say, oh yeah, we're replanting. And then they're like, oh, good, I knew you would be. And,
Well, it's because for most people, that's the badge of you're doing things right.
Yeah.
It's got, these are people that don't understand sustainability issues.
Yeah.
And almost any issue of sustainability is incredibly complex. I've worked a fair amount with people regarding fisheries and sustainable seafood. And if there's anything I've learned is that there is absolutely not one easy answer. Hell, there aren't even five easy answers.
No, there's
at
not.
All, because they involve ecological systems, financial, economic systems, social systems. it's incredibly complex, and almost any issue of sustainability is. So the best thing to do is just say, yeah, we're replanting.
But behind that whole thing, that's what we're doing. So I came up with this little answer that I pick and choose who to give it to. And I say, well, you know, wood doesn't just grow on trees.
And I like that.
Yeah, it just doesn't grow on trees. Apples grow on trees.
Indeed.
But wood doesn't.
Nope.
So who cuts down the apple tree to get the apple? You'll never get another apple.
That's it.
Wood grows on a forest. And if you cut down the forest, you're not getting any more wood. But if you leave the forest like you leave the apple tree, it's going to keep making wood.
Sure.
Like the apple tree will keep making apples.
Sure.
So you don't have to replant the apple tree every time. You don't have to tie buds on the tree or do anything. The apples come. You just feed it and you do husbandry to that tree. And by the same token, if you don't ruin the forest, I'm going to get ebony forever. And sometimes people can understand that. Oh, you mean so you don't really need to replant? Well, you know, you can maybe get a leg up if you grow some little trees and you cut down a tree and put a tree in its place.
But that's one part of a much larger equation.
Leave the forest intact. Don't ruin the forest. And those trees will come. And don't cut more trees than the forest is willing to give. You know, and use the whole tree. You know? So that means the brown ebony, the brown and black ebony. You know, the ebony that I have one that I like to call marble cake. Because you're smiling really
big on
that.
I like
that.
I like marble cake.
Yeah, because it's brown and black and white, and it's just gorgeous, you know. It's just gorgeous.
As you have this this sense of, as you've spent years making guitars now and sourcing materials, as you become more knowledgeable about how these bigger systems work, that's obviously, or at least I'm assuming, is carried over into other parts of your life. You're aware of other things now. You mentioned, you know, food, our food system. That's beautiful. See, I'm looking at pictures of these strips of streaked mahogany on Bob's
ebony.
Phone.
Yeah.
Sorry, ebony. And my thing would be, why would I want just black if I could have that?
Exactly. So it's that thing where you say to yourself, I want to change how people think, instead of what they pay, you know. So
I would much rather have. I'd much rather have that.
I hijacked your
sentence. So you're more aware of other systems around you, like food systems.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're a vegan now.
I'm a vegan now.
Was that are you going to be a vegan forever? You think?
I think yes.
What made this come about? Because I'm always interested when people make really, really big food changes. I want to hear about it.
A lot of things. 8 years ago, I went in for my 50 year birthday checkup, and I walked out with diabetes, type 2 diabetes. Oh, what a bummer, you know? Okay.
This is why I haven't gone for mine. I'm 51. I'm still putting it off because I'm sure there's stuff I just don't want to know.
Yeah. And my doctor said, you know, if it's white, don't eat it.
If it's white, don't eat it.
You know, that was, so I was like, I got to learn about this. So I made it my vocation to learn about it. And I was able to control it for a long, 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 long time without any insulin or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, if I had a do-over on some things, boy, could I do some things different. But I don't have a do-over on some things.
No.
But I've been able to maintain really good health through diet and really good blood sugar control. Along the way, I read a book called The China Study. It's a great book. You're nodding your head like you know the book.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those books that people that have made big changes often cite.
Well, you know, I read that book, and I was a vegan from the couch to the refrigerator. And I opened the thing and had a liverwurst sandwich, and I guess I'm not going to be a vegan. And I thought about it some more, and some years went by, and I really had gotten myself into eating nothing but meat and fat because it's the non-carb diet. So you're looking at someone who really had survived for a long time on a pretty, I'll say an Atkins diet, so listeners could be able to relate
sure.
it to something.
Okay.
I have very, very few carbohydrates because carbohydrates raise your blood sugar.
Indeed.
And
especially simple carbs. Yeah,
especially simple carbs. But when you're real insulin resistant, when you really are a diabetic, they all raise your carbs. Oatmeal, yeah. Candy,
carbs all raise.
Do the same
yeah.
thing.
Yeah,
you know. So then a year ago on the 10th of this month, my 26-year-old daughter went in for cancer surgery. And when she came out, started working on her health, and she'd always been she's the one of us who's never sick. And all of a sudden, she's got cancer. And she's like, how ironic is that? I'm the one that's not sick. I'm the one that grows a garden. I'm the one that makes all my food from scratch. I'm the one that does all that. And I get this. Well, she comes out and she decides she's going to do more. And one thing led to another. And she goes, I'm a vegan, Dad. And I said, so am I. And my wife said, so am I. And her sister said, so am I. And her sister's fiance said, so am I. And the five of us turned vegan that day. And I thought, you know what? I reread the China study, and I reread the follow-up book called Whole while I was at that. And I read a couple of books on diabetes, how veganism can cure it. Well, I don't believe it can cure it. It can control it.
It can control it.
That's all. That's all it can do. However, ironically, after 90 days or so, all I eat is plant-based carbohydrate type food, way, 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 way more than I ever, but I use less insulin than I did before. And I control my blood sugar just fine. I thought, I'm going to test some of these things.
And mm-hmm. Because that's the kind of guy you are.
So the first thing I did is I went out on day one and I got complete blood workup. Mm-hmm. And on day 60, before I had to go to Africa to work in the sawmill and I knew my diet would get screwed up, I did another blood test because I wanted to see the difference. My blood sugar didn't suffer. But one thing that I had is I had gotten to that age where they were starting to burn off pre-basal skin cancers from my
face.
Sure,
sure, me too.
And so I thought, well, if not ingesting animal protein can turn off cancer, like a book like the China study says,
that China study suggests,
then let me see it work. So check this out. Those were the two on my forehead getting ready to be burned off.
Okay.
That was 2 weeks later. Now, mind you, I've been burning them off for a couple of years now, and they keep
coming
out.
As we all
out.
Do, yeah. And
that was 4 weeks into it, and you're looking at me now. Now, when those came off, they converted into from this pre-basal thing that is kind of a deep, it's not a scab, you can't pick it off.
Right.
You know, if everyone's
yep.
had one, you... And what happened is it turned into a sore, like a pimple, a scab. You could pick a scab off, and eventually it went away. The amazing thing is that about 12 or 20 more of those things popped out of my face, the sore, the pimple, the scab. They were exactly like the one. I really believe they were pre-basal skin cancers that hadn't emerged yet. They were that small. You're looking at me. They're gone. I stopped playing guitar because I had arthritis in this finger so bad I couldn't play guitar, and it's gone. My fingers straightened out. It was at a 45-degree angle 3 months ago. I couldn't play. Now my knuckle is almost back. Anyways, that's anecdotal, but it's more than anecdotal to me. And my cholesterol fell to 130-something, and I gained weight because the food's so delicious. So now I have to work on that part, you know.
So your person became a vegan and actually gained weight.
Yeah. It's too good.
Because most people that are vegans lose weight.
Well, I mean, that's probably because they go straight to, I eat salad and I can't think of anything else to make for myself. But it's amazing the vegan things a person can make and how delicious it is. And what's so funny is I never in my life would have ever thought that I would be a guy that didn't want the meat. But then I started realizing that I had eaten only meat for nearly 8 years, and I was always jealous of your baked potato and your piece of bread and your rice and your quinoa and all the things that I wouldn't eat. And now that I flipped it around the other way, I am not jealous of your steak or your hamburger or your cheese or your milk.
Are you eating white food, though? We have a potato?
Yes.
We have rice?
Yes. I will. Moderation, because I'm still a diabetic, but in moderation, right. Where before moderation. It was nothing.
What do you miss now? How long has it been?
90 days.
I don't know how you feel.
I feel great.
What do you miss?
I'm going to tell you the honest truth.
Well, I would expect
I don't
to.
Miss anything that I don't eat. I have
my
have
rides
an airport
here.
There.
Yeah. You got an airport, yeah.
I have access to really good salmon every time my...
But you can't have that. You're vegan.
I know. So the other day when my friend from Washington came down, they supply our spruce. I told you about this company.
Yeah.
And he lives out on an island. Well, okay, this is the stuff you want.
This is the real stuff.
And it's flash frozen, and he buys... He gets it 1,000 pounds at a time, has it, and he brings down coolers of the stuff. And I'm like, okay, well, for two meals, I'm not going to be a vegan. I'm going to take two of these. I used to take more than I could carry. I can't think of a day that I want to eat those now. You know what I mean? It's
where are they, Bob? Because I'll be happy to take your hand. I'll cook. I'll show you exactly how to cook them, and I'll eat them. I got absolutely no problem with that. Because I'm not sure I could pass up certain fish. That would be really, really hard for me.
Okay, so I just went camping. Let's just say, what if you do something 100%, but once in a while you don't do it?
Then it's not 100%.
Then it's not 100%, it's 99.9%. Do I get the benefit of being 100%? Probably. Sometimes it's a quest with no destination, right? So I just spent 12 days in Baja doing my annual trip. We catch fish from the shore. I mean, 15-pound halibut from the shore we stand there and catch, and we make food with this fish. From fish tacos to I'll make chipinos with clams we catch and fish we catch and this stuff, and it's pretty good stuff.
I want to hang out with you on a more regular basis.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's good food.
So I made, but you're not eating it.
So I had in 12 days when yep. there was fresh fish every single day, I had a fish taco one day. And I had some bites of fish in this chipino that I make. I made it two times. And I put seafood in it for everybody, even though I used vegetable base to get there. I pulled out vegetable stock on the first day. And then I said, oh, I'm going to have a bowl and have a piece of this fish. So I did it. I'm as healthy as I was the day before.
I think you got to know when to bend.
Yeah.
You know, that, and I don't think that if you and I were on a beach and pulled in a 15-pound halibut, I think it would just be wrong to not eat that halibut. I just don't think I could do it.
So what was interesting is the second time around, I noticed that the first time I ate the chipino, I ate the meat, and I said, I don't like this as much as I used to like it.
You're losing your taste for it.
Yeah, it's not that I didn't. It was all the vegetables had way more interesting flavor
and texture, I imagine.
It was better on my tongue than I was like, what did I think was the greatest thing about this fish before? So it goes all the way back to I'd rather change someone's mind about what color the ebony is than get them to pay more. And sometimes it's a diet that worked for me. I don't miss it very much at all. I help everyone dig clams. I fish. I help clean them. And then I ate a few bites of it, and it was good, familiar. But it didn't make me think, oh, gosh, I miss this so mad. I was perfectly happy to take my vegetable stock that was really good. I have a Mexican restaurant near my house that I've eaten at. It's a taco shop, but more than a taco shop. But you order at the counter and you sit at the tables. The guy who owns it's a great cook. He's the son of the owner, but he's in his late 30s or so now, and he's a great cook. And let me tell you something. A Mexican knows how to make recipes taste Mexican.
Indeed.
And I have a really hard time doing that, even if I do what he tells me to do. You know?
No, I understand. No, I understand 100%.
My soup base starts to turn more Italian than Mexican. And mm-hmm. Ray, I'm going to be down there. I want to make a gallon. And I know you make 10 gallons of soup base but what would you put in for a gallon? And he tells me, well, I go in there and now I'm a vegan. So he makes me vegan things, you know, and I learn how to cook some stuff from him. And I pick up these little tips here and there. And I make things and bring it in, you know. I made my tofu a la Mexicana It's like, wow, this is good. So I made a burrito and took it down. Ray, eat this. You got to eat this. I'm standing up. He brings his cooks out from the back, and he's like, eat this. And they're like, so it's huevos a la mexicana. He's like, no, it's not. It's tofu. And they're like, well, no, this can't be true, you know. So sometimes you're doing a look-alike thing or a taste-alike thing, mm-hmm. and that's legitimate. But sometimes that's kind of like putting plastic on a dashboard to make it look like wood.
Right.
When you say, no, make it look like plastic. Plastic's legitimate. Make it look like plastic.
Make it look like what it is.
And so I tend to cook. I have a friend here who's worked for me for 21 years. We're good buddies. He goes camping with me down there. He lives in Tijuana. He comes up every single day. And there's a lot of vegan things in Mexico. A lot of meat substitutes and stuff that you can buy dry and sprinkle in, and it tastes like you've got ground beef in there. So I took some of that on the day that everyone's making ceviche, and I go, I want my section of everything before you put the fish in. And I'm going to just put some of this dried soy stuff in it and mm-hmm. let it soak up all those flavors, and that'll be my ceviche. And people were like, can I have a bite of yours? That looks pretty good. You know, it's really pretty funny. And I have an employee in our Tecate factory whose wife owns a vegan Mexican restaurant. So she's given me some Mexican recipes. And
nice.
I tried those things out. So it's,
you've got inside lines on a few things. That's good.
I learn how to make some things.
That's, I think, one of the biggest problems that people that I know that have made the switch over to veganism is they don't know the tricks of the trade. You know, they don't know how to maximize certain flavors or certain textures.
Right.
I have that problem myself.
Yeah. If you talk about what do I miss the most, I would say cheese is a hard thing to give up. But I learned how to make good, legitimate, good cashew cream cheese.
You tell me.
And one of the reasons I was able to learn how to do that is because the person, our safety officer, our director of safety here, used to be a master brewer in his previous life.
Okay.
And he still makes wine, beer, and cheese. And Fred knows a lot about it. He can rattle off the names of bacteria.
And coagulants and all sorts of
all
things.
All that stuff. Well, it just turned out that he brought me some cheese, a little packet of fromage blanc
mm-hmm.
starter. From a place, he buys it here in town. And he said, try this in your cashews. And so I grind up cashews I blend cashews with water until it looks like a milkshake, to where if you pick it out and you rub it between your thumb and your finger, there's no grit.
Right.
And then I put some of that, I keep it cool so it's not too hot to kill the bacteria, because those big blenders will
they
heat
create
it up.
A lot of heat, yeah. Big Vitamixes and stuff.
And so as I add water, I add ice water. And I can't figure out how to make it without it being too liquid. So it takes a while later for that liquid to come out, even if it might not drip through cheesecloth. But it does firm up as it gets older, a week, 2-3 weeks
slowly
older.
Slowly dries. And
you put that stuff in it, and on day one, it's cashew wallpaper paste. And day two, it's cheese. Now, it's not cheese that melts. But you know what?
But it's got texture and flavor.
You put that on a cracker or a bagel or a sandwich or whatever, and it is straight up good.
Now, had you pulled off that trick before he gave you that particular starter?
The first times I did, I didn't use starters. I used lemon and vinegar, apple cider. I made it tangy, not
right.
sharp.
Right. You used acid coagulant.
And then the next time I did it, I thought, no, I think I need a bacteria in here. So I went to my vitamin box and I pulled out 2 probiotics.
Yeah.
And I dumped them in there. And it turned it into cheese, but not quite as good as this stuff. This
no.
stuff is the perfect thing for that. And I'm experimenting with other things, but just that one little thing in my life satisfies that whole need for the whole cheese family pretty much.
It's interesting that you started with an acid. You went to a bacteria,
mm-hmm.
and then finally yeast.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah, so is it yeast or is it bacteria? It's
well, what he brought you sounds like it was...
I could show you a pack, and we can see what's in it, so you can...
Because, you know, usually yeast isn't involved in cheese making.
No,
it's a bacteria.
Just bacteria.
So it's a bacterial starter of some type. It's a mixture.
I think there's 5 bacteria in this one.
Okay,
and
to get along with each other.
It's made to make a soft white cheese.
Okay.
You know?
Sometimes those also have another coagulant, like a rennet in it or something, but that's not vegan,
this one
of course,
doesn't
so
have
you can't
that.
Do that.
And so when you first make this stuff, it's a little liquidy,
uh-huh.
but it firms up as time goes on. If I can hold back eating it, I'm going to let some of it sit there for 6 months and see what it does, because I think it'll probably go hard. You know, it'll become semi-hard. But I,
it depends.
On
it
one of them, I kept opening it up and peeking at it, and then that ruined it.
Yeah.
And then Fred said, no, because you had CO2 up above it, and it was keeping everything. You need to just close it.
Yeah, and forget about
away.
It. Because once you start oxidizing stuff, it's oxygen's not good.
I didn't know anything about
processes.
The CO2 blanket that was sitting up there.
Yeah.
Then I discovered the things I discovered this late in life, like who's been keeping this from me? Who's been keeping sauerkraut from me all these years? All I ever had was cabbage cooked in vinegar. But not real sauerkraut.
No, fermented. You got to ferment your own sauerkraut.
So guess what? I have sauerkraut in my refrigerator right now that Vlad brought me. He's Ukrainian. He's like, well, me and my wife, we make sauerkraut. My wife makes it every week. So he brought me their homemade stuff. You know, she puts it in a bucket and throws some salt in it and puts a lid on it, comes away, comes back a few days later. And I found a few brands that you could buy of, you know, real live sauerkraut. Bubbles is a brand that's really good. And
you haven't made your own yet?
I haven't made my own yet because...
You know, we did a whole episode, a Good Eats episode. Did you see the Good Eats episode about
that? I
didn't see that one. Well, then you've got to download our recipe for it because it's like about a 10-day perk, as I call it, because it sits there in bubbles. But it's one of the great magic tricks of food because it's like the thing that makes the sauerkraut's the thing you don't put in there.
That's right.
Bacteria. All you're doing is adding salt to govern which bacteria can get in.
That's right.
And every time I make it, it's like, this is a magic trick. I shouldn't be able to do this.
And it's so good. You can't quit eating it.
And there's no reason to quit eating it because
no.
It's fantastic for you.
Exactly.
I mean, sauerkraut, really good kraut is almost the best thing you could eat. Because the bacteria are very friendly for us, the acids are good for us, and the freaking cabbage is fantastic for you.
There's nothing bad about eating that. And
no.
I can't
eat it all day long.
Get enough of it, and I do. I eat it every single day. I take some, you know, good rye bread or some of that Ezekiel bread, you know, that's sprouted grains, and I put some of my cream cheese on it and some of the sauerkraut.
Cream cheese meaning some of your cream, your
cashew cream cheese.
Just trying to make sure you don't cross the line there, Bob.
No, I keep that stuff in stock.
Okay.
I'll give you a bite of it before you leave.
I would love to try it.
Yeah.
I would love to try it.
It's really quite good.
Because I've been flirting with at least going temporarily, like do half a year vegan and see how I feel.
You know, I said when I did this that I'm going to do it for a year because I can do anything. The way I've eaten for the last 8 years, I shun these things and I barely eat them. You know, the last 8 years has been don't eat carbs.
Right.
And I've done a pretty good job of that. And for you diabetics out there, I have to use some insulin, but I maintain about a 5.2 or 5.4 A1C, which is like non-diabetic levels. My blood sugar control is real good. And yet, if I don't control it, I'll have an A1C of 9 that fast.
Boom.
And I'll have blood sugar rates that are up in the high 200s and low 300s, just like that. So I'm not a diabetic I'm a real diabetic, right? And I also watched my pancreas die right before my very eyes through blood tests. I just watched it go from making an abundance of insulin to almost none. And, you know, I do tests and I read. There is sort of that scientific method of things. You test things and you look at it, and then you have to believe the results. That's the hard part of the scientific method is you have to believe the result.
Trust them. At least
and,
to know that they're real.
And maybe make some choices about it. So eating this way, I'm maintaining the same type of blood sugar levels, and yet these cancers went away and my arthritis went away. My cholesterol plummeted. My cholesterol wasn't bad. I was a 180 cholesterol person, but it went to, in 60 days, it went to 135.
If you're not consuming any, that certainly does change
It does things. Change some.
Your body makes its own, but...
Your body makes its own. And high carbohydrates cause high triglycerides, causes high cholesterol. So a lot of times, for some people, the smoking gun is you're putting too much too many carbs in your body that you can't do any, you can't process that.
You can't do anything with.
There's so many people we as a regular diet. Well, now that I've really learned more about meat, because when I get into something, I want to read more about it. I understand that we eat 20 times as much meat as we did when I was a kid as a population, maybe more. I can't remember the figure, but
it's huge.
It's huge, you know. And but we also eat more processed.
We eat more everything.
We eat more everything.
We eat. You know, the very, very first thing when people ask me is like, look, just don't eat as much. Start there. If nothing else, just don't eat as much.
My mom went to the doctor and he goes, well, I see you haven't lost any weight. She's not particularly fat, but she's 80 and, you know, she could drop 15 pounds. And she goes, well, I have a really good diet. You know, and she does. And he goes, great, eat less of it. You know, and I mean, that's about
it. There you go.
Great.
We're done here. Eat less of it.
So
absolutely true.
And as we get older, it's so disappointing because you really do have to eat less of it. You get it's bizarre to be a 6'1", 200-pound guy, and you're full on half a sandwich now. Like, what happened to me? What's going on? You know. So, as I got into that veganism, then I'm reading a book now called Eating Animals. It's a really great book. I have a friend who works for us, who lives in our works in our Amsterdam office, and he sent me that book when he found out I was a vegan. It's just sort of tells about factory farming, and it's very pragmatic. It looks at both sides of all the stories, you know, and but it's one of the many things that I've read and watched to come to the realization of what's happening. And so I sort of think that it's kind of funny, but I could go through all of this effort to sustain the wood in the forest and buy an ebony mill and talk to my customers. But if I wanted to give everyone that played a Taylor guitar a message that could help the environment, I would say, cut your meat in half or in third. It could do more for the environment than all of these other things that we're talking about which wood comes on your guitar. It's amazing when you find out that raising meat puts out more greenhouse gases than the entire transportation industry.
I'll be honest. I recently wrote an article for Wired Magazine about a company in Missouri called Beyond Meat, which makes a chicken analog out of mostly soy protein and pea protein with a little carrot and amaranth for fiber. And like you, I'm a research hog. Once I get into a subject, I want wide and deep.
Right.
And by the time I was done really researching the story, I got to the point of realizing I wish that I hadn't taken the assignment because I now know things that I wish I could unknow.
Yeah.
And I can't unknow them. And now I have the weight of that on me.
Yeah.
I thought I knew a lot. I thought that I was educated. But in looking back, I realized I was only learning the things that allowed me to continue to do what I was doing. And so what I was doing was I was learning what supported a system in myself,
right?
As both a cook, as a teacher, and as a consumer,
right.
I was only bolstering my house, so to speak.
Sure.
And I get done with the research to this, and it's like, crap! I can't unknow this stuff. I can't go back to where I was. I'm through my own particular looking glass on this subject, and now I'm going to actually have to live with that.
Yeah, you have to think about it. You have to do something.
I think about it, and I got to do something about it. And the truth is you are absolutely right. You know, if I wanted to do the most possible for my planet, I would go to every one of my fans and say, cut your meat in half. You're right.
It is the single Prius.
Look, man, I could go out. I could drive an old beat up Camaro for the rest of my life, guzzling 3 miles a gallon and not eat beef, and I would be doing a better thing. That is not a message that is popular. That is not a message that goes on without resistance.
Gosh,
because
you're talking about what people eat.
Well, you know, the meat industry. You know, it's change that's very, very hard to generate because there's a huge amount of marketing money to keep it going the way that it is, the way the systems currently are.
And they can market to children.
Yep.
Which, and all it has to be is you could just start with a Happy Meal, and that's, you know, that's where you can start marketing to children. They're not so and you know, if I think about the difference between kids now, so I'm at this age where there's, I don't have grandkids yet, but there's a lot of grandkids in the group, in the friend and family circle.
Sure.
You know, my kids' friends are having kids, and there's all these babies, and I'm thinking, these poor kids don't have a chance. And so we're just sitting there with the parents that are in their 30s, in their late 20s, of these young kids, and I'm like, you really have to listen to at least this, or you have to read at least that, or you have to, because when I was a kid, we'd have a fast food hamburger four times a year, and now you have them
four times a day.
It's true. And you've got children now that might not really be able to name the vegetables, and they won't eat something unless it's in the form of a pizza, a burger, or a burrito, you know? And if it's
or
not,
a chicken finger.
A chicken finger. And how do and they don't, chickens aren't shaped like stars. They just really aren't.
No.
And I read...
Starfish are, though.
Starfish are.
Yeah, starfish are. It's not a lot to eat there. Not a lot on a starfish.
Well, it's such a touchy subject. It's almost like we're going to talk about somebody's religion or their politics, you know, when we're going to start talking about the food that they eat.
You can't remove those two things.
You can't.
Because when you're talking about which parts of the planet you're going to ingest...
Right.
That resides on the bookshelf right next to religion and politics. You can't separate those things.
No, you can't. And
you know, and what you believe on either one of those subjects has to come to bear on the other. So it's touchy and difficult.
So don't you feel like you kind of nudge people along and you nudge yourself along, and once in a while, something happens to a person like me where you just. One day it's you ate one way, and the next day you eat another way. And in this case, I found out that it was... I told people on day one, I said, I am not doing this for moral reasons. I'm doing it as a health test. But the moral reasons are creeping in. And I'm not even going to say it's a moral... There's some moral reasons in there. The treatment of animals, right? I look into the eyes of my dog, and I've looked in the eyes of horses and cows back in when I was a kid, and I go to my uncle's and aunt's farms, and then I think of how they're living now so that we can eat them. It's a different thing now than it was. It's a different thing than when I was in Tunisia, because I like to go out to the Sahara Desert and drive my Land Cruiser through it and be out in the sand dunes for 2 weeks at a time with my friend who lives in Germany, and we go down there. So Tunisia was a place that we could go for a long time before it all fell apart, and we'd be out there, and you'd be in a little tiny village. It's pretty rural life. And you go, well, oh, here's a little, it's kind of like a taco stand, except it's a shish kebab stand. And yeah, we want some. And so pretty soon here comes this kid with two lambs in a wheelbarrow. Where are we going, Daddy? I'm like, oh, I got to watch this. I just have to. They take him out back, and they slit his throat, and they butcher him.
And you eat it.
And we eat it. And you go, wow, that's hard to watch. But that wasn't as hard to watch as the stories as the films I've seen about pushing disease-dead cows away with a bulldozer into a hole because the poor guy can't stand up. Because his feet won't support
Americans him. Are, and it's one of the things I talk about in my show, is we're far more concerned with how things die than how they live.
Right.
You know, when I was in culinary school, I had the opportunity to work a lamb slaughter, which wasn't something that I actually wanted to do at a small abattoir that was family run. But I went and I did it because I thought to be a cook, to work professionally with food and not know what it is to take life mm-hmm. is somehow... For me, at least, it was just something that had to be done, lest I'd be a hypocrite.
Right.
I didn't enjoy it. I don't want to do it again. I didn't stop eating meat right away, but it certainly jarred me mm-hmm. into thinking about systems. And you know what? If something's raised the way that it ought to be raised and is put to the knife for eating, I find that more acceptable than the way that we make things live in order to slaughter them. So it's... I'm not going to condemn meat eating, even if I do go vegan for a while. I'm not going to do that because it is something that I don't think that just not eating meat entirely is going to fix the problem. Usually stewardship requires using something. You know, it's like with the wood.
You're so right.
You're better off. Well, when it comes to conservation, I'm more of a Teddy Roosevelt kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I think you can save it and hunt it at the same time. I think you can cut it down and save it at the same time.
I
think
have a message I give to our customers. I've said this 100 times. I say, I want to tell you that to save ebony, we have to use ebony. So you and I
yes.
feel exactly the same.
No,
about that.
You actually do. That is the completion of the process of stewardship.
That's right.
of something and sustaining something is that you have to take it out of the back end. The system has to revolve. So there must be use for something. And the lovely thing about that is that as human beings, we can assess value from something, usually only at the user end of it. So, you know, if I buy one of your guitars that's made out of this mahogany, that is now a different product. Those trees are now different. That forest is now different because I am using it. And that changes everything. To say that we can conserve something simply by not doing it at all is, I think, the last refuge and in a way suggests failure. You know, I know
Absolutely.
A lot of people that simply want to close fisheries.
Yeah, that's not
the And answer. Sometimes if a fishery collapses, that may be the last resort is simply, okay, we're just not going to do more harm anymore. But you know what? Those fisheries, the fisheries that are healthy around the world now are the ones that are actually being fished. You know, if you fish something to collapse, it's like we're probably never going to get Georgia's Bank back, you know, because right. the cod are gone. It's a desert now because the system, the entire system collapsed. But the healthy fisheries in the world now are being fished. And that's how you make them healthy
right.
in a way.
Yeah.
And I would say the same is true with a forest or any other system. You've got to take out of it.
Yeah,
have to use
I believe it. The same thing. And newsflash, I also believe that business is the solution to poverty, not charity. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't use charity or give a lot, because I do. My parents taught me when I was young, if I made a dollar, 10 cents of it had to be given, you know? And it's what I had to do. And but you could almost say you hear a lot about Western medicine versus more holistic medicine or Eastern. They talk about how Western modern medicine is great in an emergency, not necessarily great if they prescribe a bunch of contradictory drugs to support a system that's falling apart, where maybe nutrition could do that. But if my arm's broken or I'm having a heart attack, boy, I want the best.
Or your daughter gets cancer.
Or your daughter gets cancer.
You were very grateful to have Western medicine when
absolutely.
That happened.
Absolutely. And in a way, as an analogy, charity is often for when I've fallen and I can't get up. But then you want to develop some business, some economy, some way that a person can not stay fallen. And you can't. And so, in reality, I try and temper all of the things that I think. So I'm an environmentalist who believes in cutting trees. And
that makes you a conservationist.
Conservationist,
I
yes.
think.
I don't really like the word environmentalist. I say it too much. I haven't scrubbed it out of my
that's why
vocabulary.
That's why I jumped on conservationist.
I think you're giving me a new word to use.
Well, it's a proactive word. Mm-hmm. And environmentalist is an emotional word to me.
Yeah.
Whereas conservationist, that requires activity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the difference between love and marriage.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
marriage is a thing you do, and conservation is a thing you do.
Right.
It's a system, and it tends to take into account economics, and it takes into account. You know, environmentalists will say, I don't care about the fishermen, save the fish.
Right.
I don't think that's the way to do it. The fishermen matter, too.
Absolutely.
You know, the whole system matters.
Yeah.
And it's very easy for environmentalists to hug the tree and
yeah.
screw the forest.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, I kind of like the way that sounds.
Yeah.
Hug the tree, screw the forest. I may use that again in the future.
So
Bob Taylor, thanks for the conversation. Thanks for the sauerkraut.
Absolutely.